This is the first of series. Okay, this is a first of a series of programs sponsored by the class of 1968, and I have to. And I have to say, Bob Haldeman and I are really pleased to be a part of this program, the way we're starting our series off today. William Taubman is going to speak to us about his book, Gorbachev, His Life and Times. Professor Taubman is Bertrand Snell Professor of Political Science Emeritus here at Amherst. I think we can look back at the way Russia has progressed, not progressed, developed after the split up of the Soviet Union, and we can be disappointed. But I think it could also have been a lot worse. And one of the reasons that it wasn't worse, I think, is because of Mr. Gorbachev. I think he's a very important historical figure of our time. Professor Taubman's book on Gorbachev was one of the five finalists of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography, and an earlier book that he wrote on Nikita Khrushchev won a Pulitzer Prize for biography and also won the National Book Critics Award for biography. Professor Taubman has brought a number of his books for sale. They'll be available in the lobby, signed copies. I'm very happy, honored to be able to make this introduction, and I hope that we now give Professor Taubman a warm welcome.
Thank you very much. Let's see if I can, you can hear me? Good. I realized as I was coming over here that my first year at Amherst College was your last year, you members of the class of 68. I arrived in the fall of 67. And that's one of the reasons why when people occasionally say to me, we remember you and we liked your teaching and all the rest, and somebody down here just said that, I wonder, because I know very well how I taught that first year. I definitely got the hang of it after a while. It took about 20 years, but I finally did. I also wanted to just correct Mike on a minor matter. I didn't bring the books. The books are here from the bookstore. So I will get a royalty, but I didn't personally carry them up here on my back. And I would be glad to sit out there if people want to buy some copies and sign them when the time comes. Well, I wanted to start with a quote from the 19th century British historian Thomas Carlyle. He said, "History is but the biography of great men." Wrong. Obviously wrong because there are women as well as men, but also wrong because there are social forces and economic conditions and international developments and ideas and institutions and many other things that shape history, not just great men and women. But in some cases, and Gorbachev is one of them, individual leaders do have a decisive impact on history. He helped to destroy Soviet totalitarianism, which was on its last legs when he took over, but it was gone, at least for a while, when he left office. He, more than anyone else, including Ronald Reagan and George Bush, although they helped him, ended the Cold War. I think there are two key words that you have to keep in mind when you think about the claim that a great leader had such a decisive impact on history. One is power. Gorbachev had the power that came with being the leader of a still totalitarian system in the Soviet Union, which meant that he had more power than even the most powerful democratic country leaders, because he didn't have interest groups or a rule of law or a constitution or a separation of powers to constrain him, as we know can be the case in democracies. So that power was one thing. But the other thing I want to stress about him is uniqueness. Gorbachev did what nobody else would have done in his place in the Soviet Union. Now, if he had done what others would have done in his place, we could say, well, he shared the values that other leaders had, and in acting, he reflected those values, and therefore what he did resembled what they did. Or we might say that he faced a situation which made demands on the leader. Others would have responded to the demands similarly as he did. But that isn't the case. He did things that nobody else in the Politburo, in the Central Committee, in the leadership of the Soviet system would have done. Now, if you happen to remember, and I don't expect you would, the names of all the 15 members of the Politburo, you might say, well, what about Alexander Yakovlev, who was his chief ally? Or what about Eduard Shevardnadze? You remember him, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union under Gorbachev? They supported him almost to the very end. But the point I want to make is that they would not have been in a position to do so except that he either appointed them or kept them on. In other words, they were not independent actors. They were there because he wanted them to be there. The rest of the Politburo, even though they appointed him in 1985 when he took office, quickly or not so quickly were alienated by him and what he did and turned against him. So he was unique. Now, why is that important? Because it seems to me uniqueness of this kind cries out for biography. That is, it suggests that it not only suggests, it really demands that we look at the biography of such a leader to see if we can figure out what aspects of his character help to explain the unique things that he did that nobody else with different characters would have done. So that's what I try to do in my book. I try to understand him from the beginning until quite recently and to figure out what about him explains what he did, why he did it, and why nobody else would have done it. Now, to organize these remarks, I want to pose five big questions about that period of Soviet history and what Gorbachev's involvement was, and then try to answer them. The first question is, how did Gorbachev become Gorbachev, the man, in quotes? How did a peasant boy who wrote a high-flown essay in praise of Stalin when he was in high school grow up to become the gravedigger of Soviet communism? Number two, how on earth did the regime ever permit him to destroy it with all of the checks and guarantees they had against somebody like him coming to power? Number three, why did he dream of democratizing the Soviet Union, a country that it had been in existence only since 1917, but its predecessor, Russia, had been for centuries. And in all those centuries, there had only been a few months, chaotic months in 1917, when it experienced democracy. And a lot of people learned from those few months that democracy was a bad thing because it brought about the Bolsheviks, the Bolshevik Revolution. So how did Gorbachev come up with the dream of democratizing this country, and why did he flounder and fail? Number four, how did Gorbachev and arch-conservative American President Ronald Reagan turn out to be almost perfect partners in ending the Cold War, something that none of us foresaw at the time when Gorbachev came in and Reagan had been beating the drums of Cold War for several years? And last question, why did Gorbachev let the Soviet Union's East European empire crumble without firing a shot to protect it and defend it? Now, some of these questions can only be answered with the help of references to the non-individual effects, that is, of Gorbachev. One has to talk, if we had more time and if I wanted to, I'd have to talk about ethnic separatism. I'd have to talk about the collapse of the Soviet economy. I'd have to talk about other factors that played a role. But in keeping with my focus on Gorbachev and his personality, I'm going to focus on him and try to answer these five questions with reference to him. So let's begin with that first one. How did Gorbachev become Gorbachev? And here I want to distinguish between his childhood, between 1931 when he was born and 1950 when he headed off to Moscow University. And the second period is at the Moscow University itself for 5 years. Well, as I say, he was born in 1931. That means he grew up in terrible times. This was the period of famine, which took the lives of two of his uncles and one of his aunts. This was the period of collectivization of Soviet agriculture, in which millions died, either being brutalized where they lived or on freight cars taking them to Siberia or in the camps in Siberia in which they were dumped. The late 1930s was the period of the Great Terror of Stalin, in which hundreds of thousands were shot and millions more died. Both of Gorbachev's grandfathers, maternal and paternal, were picked up and arrested and sent into the gulag in the late 1930s, although, as I'll mention in a moment, they both managed by a kind of miracle to return. The Nazis occupied Gorbachev's village, the small village in southern Russia where he was born and raised, for several months in 1942. And late in the war, 1944, and again after the war, famine struck again. So you see what I mean by these were terrible times. But somehow, Gorbachev managed to emerge from these terrible times confident, with self-esteem, optimistic, trusting in his fellow citizens, quite remarkable given the orgy of mutual suspicion which Stalin and his henchmen had fomented among Soviet people. Trusting, optimistic, confident. And all of these turn out to be very important later on for explaining his rise, what he did that was important and worthwhile, and also the mistakes he made that contributed to his own eventual fall. Now, where does this come from? Where do these characteristics come from of his? Well, we'd have to allow for genes, of course. But his upbringing, I think, I try to describe it in the book, was very important. And this is going to lead me to move on. Oh, by the way, usually my wife, Jane, who taught here for many years with me, is in the audience. She couldn't come today. But what she does, among other things, is tell me when I forget to advance the slides, the pictures. And she's not here, so somebody out there, go like this if I'm not doing it right. But whoops, that's backwards. Okay. This is a picture of young Gorbachev with his grandfather, his maternal grandfather and grandmother. And I think you can see in this picture what he describes in his memoirs and in the interviews. Jane and I had 8 long interviews with Gorbachev over the course of 10 years. You can see the kind of mutual affection. He's got his hand on his grandfather's thigh, and grandmother has her arm on his shoulder. Grandfather has his arm on Gorbachev's shoulder. Gorbachev describes his grandfather as tender person. That's not the kind of description one often finds of Soviet men, particularly in that brutal time. Now I'm going to move on, if I've got this right, to a picture of his father, Sergei Gorbachev. And I think, again, you can see in his face something that Gorbachev says about him and that other neighbors of his and colleagues who worked with him say, that he was a lovely man, a sweet man, a man who didn't try to dominate Gorbachev but encouraged him. At one point in the late 40s, when Gorbachev was a teenager, he and his father competed in a competition to bring in the grain with a big harvester, and they won the competition. They worked 24/7, day and night, rain or shine, in the fields. And when it was over, his father was awarded the Order of Lenin, which is the highest order the Soviet Union could award. And the father asked if Gorbachev could also be awarded one. The answer was, he's too young. But they did award him a medal that he wore throughout his university career. It was the Order of the Red Labor Banner. Now, you may wonder about his mother. Here she is with Gorbachev as a boy. And here is another picture of her, not quite as good a picture, with Gorbachev and his younger brother, who was 16 years younger than he. Now, his mother was not as tender as his father. She was, in fact, quite harsh. And in one of our interviews, I think our first one, Jane and mine, with Gorbachev, he shocked us by suddenly saying, when talking about his mother, that he said, when I was 12 years old, she picked up her belt to whip me again. Well, I was surprised he would say this. And then he went on and he said, I grabbed her arm and I pulled it down and I said, never again. And then he said to us, to Jane and me, she began to weep. And before we could even ask why, he said, because I was the last thing she could control, and now she could no longer control me. Well, she was a pretty tough woman, but she also kept him alive in World War II, which his father spent at the front and miraculously survived 4 or 5 years at the front. And I don't want to fall into the trap of seeming to reduce a complicated person to the few things that I've told you about his upbringing. But I do think that his grandfathers and his father helped him to think of himself as a person of special gifts who could deserve to be a leader, and as he was in high school and later on. And I'm also tempted to think that his mother's treatment of him may have fostered in him a kind of need to receive that kind of approval and approbation from a larger audience because of the way she treated her. But these are some observations. I'm not saying they must absolutely be totally true. Let me just tell you one story, though, about Gorbachev and his girlfriend in high school that gives you the sense of what kind of young man he became before he left for Moscow University. Before I do that, I have to remember to show you a picture of him and her. He was actually a high school actor in the high school group, theater group. And she, over there, was his leading lady. And one day, she was also apparently the editor of the high school wall newspaper. And one day, he came upon her working on the newspaper in the high school and discovered she'd made some mistakes, whereupon he bawled her out, apparently rather fiercely. And then they went in to see the editorial board of the paper, and in the presence of her colleagues, he bawled her out again. And then when they left the school later that afternoon, he invited her out that evening. And she had the guts to say to him, what are you doing? First you bawl me out, chastise me in front of my peers, and then you invite me out for the evening. And to which he replied, my dear, these are two entirely different realms. So you can see that he was not only confident, maybe overconfident. And you'll see that again as I proceed. Moscow University, the elite university of the Soviet Union then, and probably still until today, like any good university, it fostered questions and doubts in his mind, even though the first 3 years he spent there were the last 3 years of Stalin's life. So this was not Amherst College, which went out of its way to foster doubts and questions among its students. But there were enough professors who'd been trained before 1917 or in the 1920s, which was a freer time for the Soviet Union, so Gorbachev began to think somewhat more freely. But it was also at Moscow University that he met two key people in his life who had a long-standing influence on him. One of them was a Czech exchange student named Zdeněk Mlynář, who turned out to be Gorbachev's best friend, as testified to not only by Gorbachev, but by several of their classmates whom Jane and I interviewed in Moscow. The interesting thing about Mlynář is that in 1968, your year, he was Alexander Dubček's chief ideologist in the Prague Spring when they tried to create communism with a human face only to be crushed by Soviet troops. Mlynář, you can tell from reading what he wrote and talking to people who knew him, was a communist, a true believer, but a believer in a kind of idealized version of vision of communism, not the Stalinist reality all around him. And Gorbachev apparently was the same kind of guy, to judge by same kinds of sources. And I'll give you another example now from this. At one point in their career at Moscow University, they were watching a movie together, which will sound to you like an oxymoron. It was a Stalinist musical comedy. There were such things, and actually I've seen quite a few of them, and they are actually quite amusing and funny, and the music's pretty good too. This one is called Cossacks of the Kuban, and it's about the peasants bringing in the harvest and singing while they work. And then once the harvest is in, the milkmaids the women, young women, rush down to the village store and buy up all the beautiful fabrics there to make beautiful dresses for themselves. Well, while they're watching this, Gorbachev leans over to Mlynarz and says, "It's not true. None of it's true. They wouldn't work if they weren't forced to, and there's nothing to buy in the stores." So there is a glimpse of Gorbachev already at that point in 1953-54, thinking more freely. Now, the other person he met, you will now see on our right there, that's Raisa. Raisa Gorbachova. And I'll show you another picture of her. Oh, whoop, that's him. We'll go back to that in a minute. She was love at first sight for him when they met. Their marriage was quite remarkable. There are so many politicians around in our days who are not faithful and not devoted. Gorbachev was devoted and faithful. He has not remarried since she died in 1999. And she was one of his teachers, in a way. She was a year ahead of him at Moscow University, although a year younger. She was in the philosophy department, which had more prestige than the law school, where he was. You may ask why the law school had little prestige. That's because this is a country without the rule of law. And people sense that. He described her to us as a maximalist, which I take it meant that she didn't like to compromise. She had principles and didn't like to compromise them. He says of himself that he too was a maximalist, but he later learned to compromise because he was a politician. And by the way, parenthetically, the word kompromis in Russian has a negative meaning. It's not something you're supposed to do, whereas in our country it is, or at least it used to be. We talked to a lot of aides who worked for both Gorbachev and Raisa, and about half of them said he should have listened to her more, and he would have done better had he done so. But about half of them said he should have listened to her less, because she was so principled as to end up stubborn and not take account of political realities. Now we go back to the picture of Gorbachev at the age when he met her. I call this Gorbachev in his French actor mode. Okay, second question. Why was Gorbachev promoted to be the leader of a regime he would eventually destroy? And here I want to distinguish between his years 1955 to 78 in Stavropol, which is a southern Russian city near where he grew up and where he climbed the greasy pole of the Communist Party, and then the years 1978 to 1985 in Moscow, where he is waiting to succeed and become the Soviet leader. In Stavropol, we talked to a lot of the people who worked with him and against him. They described him as working hard and well, although some of them hated him. He hid the heretical views that he had already developed at Moscow University, for the most part, except for talking to his close friends. And I think the key to the fact that he was promoted all the way up eventually was that he seemed to be the kind of person that the devotees of communism had hoped communism would produce. They called it the new Soviet man. And having been around enough of those people over my entire career, I know there were not that many of them. But what were his characteristics? He was honest, he was hardworking, he was incorruptible, he was idealistic. And for example, most of the people we talked to from Stavropol who had worked with him at that time raved about how well he treated his wife. And some of the women we talked to talked about how poorly they had been treated by their husbands. So what I'm saying is I think the people who promoted him, and I'll talk about them now in a minute, saw in him what they had hoped communism would produce, even though by that point they could see that the reality was often not that way around them. We met some pretty awful people whom I describe in the book, but I won't tell you about them. I'll just tell you about one who insisted he hated Gorbachev, and he described him as the Stavropol Narcissus. But this guy was Narcissus in spades. And I describe a day with this man in Stavropol, which was pretty appalling. Well, who were the leaders who saw Gorbachev, appreciated him, and promoted him? The most important one was Yuri Andropov, who was the Soviet secret police chief at the time, and later became briefly the leader, although he was not well and died pretty quickly. Andropov was one of these men who in the morning could send dissident writers to insane asylums where they'd be pumped full of tranquilizing drugs to get them out of circulation. But when he took his vacation down in Gorbachev's bailiwick in the North Caucasus mountain near Stavropol, he turned out to be a kind of poet. He liked Gorbachev. They took hikes in the country. They cooked shashlik, and they sang songs by semi-dissident bards. Even as I say, he's sending others to jail or to insane asylums. Let's take a look at a picture of Gorbachev and Andropov. This is the North Caucasus Mountains. Sitting on rocks, Gorbachev and his wife, Raisa. And who's taking their picture? Andropov. I interviewed several of the people who worked for Andropov in the mid-60s, when he was not yet secret police chief and had a reputation for being relatively enlightened. And this person said Andropov had on his desk a series of political philosophy books by some of the classics. And one day, this aide of his asked him, "Why are you reading those books?" And Andropov said, "So that I can speak as an equal with you and your colleagues who are more educated than I." So I think Andropov saw in Gorbachev an educated, enlightened communist, a true believer in communism, and that helped him to decide to push him along. Raisa was once asked, what was the crucial factor in Gorbachev's promotion? And she said, the Andropov factor. Now, from 1978 to 1985, Gorbachev is in Moscow, and the leaders are Brezhnev, and then Andropov, and then Chernenko, people whom you could think of as nearly dead men walking. And here's one of them sitting. That's Chernenko. The poor man could barely move, could barely breathe. This, I think, is an occasion when they wanted to show him voting. So what they did was they set up a fake voting booth in his hospital room to make it look as if he'd gone to the polls to vote. Well, compared to these poor old men, Gorbachev was young, dynamic, energetic, enterprising, and so he was the one they chose in 1985. To be sure, there was one other candidate whose last name was Romanov. The American pronunciation would be Romanov. And if he had lived before 1917, he had a good chance to rise to the top, along with the other Romanovs. But not in 1985, because he was a drunk as well as dim-witted, and so they promoted Gorbachev. And the conclusion I came with, too, about this rise of Gorbachev, especially in the late years, was that these men who preceded him were not hard acts to follow. They were too easy. And in that sense, they gave Gorbachev an exaggerated sense of what he, a young, vigorous man, could accomplish as Soviet leader. And when it turned out he couldn't, because of the variety of forces arrayed against him, I think it was even more devastating than it would have been if his expectations hadn't been so high. Why did Gorbachev try to democratize the Soviet Union, and why did he falter and fail? Well, as I said, he was the only one in the leadership who would have tried to do that, but there were other people in society and in lower ranks of the party. These were people who had come to political maturity in Khrushchev's age, when Khrushchev had denounced Stalin and introduced some reforms. And Gorbachev picked up where Khrushchev left off. So in that sense, there was a broader context. But I also think, again, it was personal. It was this overconfidence that went along with his heretical thinking, that he thought he could change this system, which in the end proved more than he could manage. There's one other element here, though, is that communism itself, after all, is a doctrine which teaches its adherents that you can change the world by carrying out a revolution. That's what they tried to do after 1917. And in that sense, Gorbachev's own communist background, I think, led him to exaggerate what he could accomplish
by carrying out radical reforms. Why did he fail? I mentioned ethnic separatism, economic collapse to which he contributed, international situation. The Americans took a long time to recognize him for what he really was. But again, I want to focus on him. I think he contributed to his own fate by being too confident in his ability not only to change the system, but to control the communist hardliners. At one point he said, they were like a rabid dog, and I had to keep them on a tight leash. And what that meant was he couldn't break with them. He had to keep them close. I think it was Machiavelli who may have said, keep your enemies close, but your friends even closer. No, friends close, but enemies even closer. Right, okay. I guess I needed to work on my Machiavelli too, as did Andropov. Anyway, he thought he could hold them on a tight leash, but before he could take care of them, they mounted a coup against him, which you'll remember in August of 1991. They didn't succeed, but that was really the end for him, although he lasted a few more months. He also thought he could control Boris Yeltsin. Now I'm going to skip ahead for a moment. I'll come back to these. Whoops. This is a scene from the fall of 1991. Gorbachev has come back to Moscow after the abortive coup against him, and Yeltsin, whom Gorbachev humiliated, and I document that in detail, is now humiliating Gorbachev. And in fact, this is one of the interesting psychological twists of the whole thing. Gorbachev really contributed to creating his own nemesis in Yeltsin by the way he treated him, and Yeltsin gave it back in spades. Okay, now we go back to Reagan and Gorbachev. There they are synchronizing their watches at Geneva in 1985, November. And, whoops, sorry. This is at the pool house in Geneva. The interesting thing about this summit in November 1985 is that both Gorbachev and Reagan came to the conclusion that they had made a breakthrough. And they had, in the sense that it led on to Reykjavik, the next summit, at which they almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. But when I went back and read the transcripts of their conversations at Geneva, I couldn't see any sign of a breakthrough. It looked pretty sterile. Banal jokes by Reagan, Gorbachev fighting back on the issue of SDI. So if they made a breakthrough, what accounts for it? Well, I came to the conclusion, which I try to explain in my book, that it was personal chemistry which reflected the fact that they were both very similar in certain ways. I won't go through that now. I have a passage in which I try to show that even their marriages were similar. What I do is I quote extensively from a description of Reagan's marriage, and I say, if you substitute Gorbachev for Reagan and Raisa for Nancy, they describe the same marriage. Anyway, just to give you one further bit of confirmation that this may be on the right track, I was giving a talk a few months ago at Duke University, and I was talking about the fact that Jane and I had had these 8 interviews with Gorbachev, and I said he came across as warm and informal and with a sense of humor, natural, made us feel comfortable. And I said, I have not met other world leaders, so I can't really compare him with anybody else. And at this point, one member of the audience named Jack Matlock, who was the American ambassador to the Moscow under Gorbachev, raised his hand and said, I can name somebody else who fits that description. I said, who? He said, Ronald Reagan. So a bit of evidence, but if you want to see the case made more fully, it's in the book. Okay. Why did Gorbachev allow Eastern Europe to get away without firing a shot? One reason is he was almost allergic to violence. He hated blood. He deliberately held his fire in almost every occasion, although there are some exceptions. But I think the bigger reason is that he had a dream, this vision of the future in which East and West Europe would come together and converge. They would have somewhat similar systems. and they would live together in peace and harmony. One indication of this, interestingly enough, is that one of his top aides said at one point when asked about the Berlin Wall and Gorbachev's attitude toward it, he said, Gorbachev's secret dream was to wake up one morning and find that the wall had fallen of its own weight. And that's exactly what happened. Because when the wall opened up and East Germans swarmed across it, in Moscow time on that day, November 9th, 1989, Gorbachev was asleep. They did not wake him up, perhaps because they sensed that he would not be aghast, but almost pleased. And when he did find that it had happened, he was not dismayed. He was worried, of course, about the possibility of conflict arising if East Germans rose up against their own regime and the regime used force to try to stop them. But he had this dream, and the fall of the wall was part of what would move toward its fulfillment. So when later in that year, mixed governments formed in East European countries, non-communists as well as communists, he allowed it to happen. There were a couple of occasions when hardline communists in Poland and Hungary got on the phone and tried to call him in Moscow and say, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And the answer came back, it's okay. And even when the Warsaw Pact showed signs, which it was only beginning to do at that point, of falling apart, he wasn't that worried either, because from his point of view, the dream of a future Europe was still intact. Again, too optimistic, to go back to my notion of how his personality helps to explain his actions. Well, by way of conclusion, I want to argue that I see him in a way as a hero. He organized the first free elections, mostly free in the first round, but entirely free in subsequent rounds in the Soviet Union. He created a real functioning parliament to replace the rubber stamp Supreme Soviets, which had existed until then. He turned glasnost, which in the beginning was a limited form of free speech, into entirely free or almost entirely free speech. And as I say, more than anyone, and you can ask about this if you'd like to, we can talk about it, more than anyone, I think he ended the Cold War and reduced the threat, at least at that time, of a nuclear Holocaust. But he is, I think, a tragic hero, because although he tried to save the Soviet Union, he eventually contributed to its collapse. We now know that it has reverted, Russia, its successor, has reverted, if not to full-blown totalitarianism, at least to a kind of authoritarianism under Putin, and we find ourselves in a new Cold War. But the real, the most painful tragedy of all involved his wife. Oh, going the wrong way, sorry. There she is. There she is, looking at him adoringly. And here she is at the very end, in the last year of her life, or just the year before that. Leukemia will kill her in 1999. And here is a really sad picture of Gorbachev at her funeral. The young woman to his left is their only child, Irina. So in that sense, personal as well as political, he's a tragic hero. His last book, which came out quite recently, he's now 87 and he's in frail health, but his last book is titled, I Remain an Optimist. And so one might well ask, does he really? Is he really happy, as he has told us he was? He lives alone now in a large villa outside of Moscow. While his wife was alive, she, of course, lived with him and traveled everywhere with him, thinking of it as her duty as well as her pleasure. And after she died, his daughter and two granddaughters lived with him. But she's now moved to Germany, partly because her husband needs medical care there, but also because she, like her mother, can't stand the vilification that descends on him in his own country. I think there's an irony here that Raisa was the first Soviet first lady to really look like a first lady and act like a first lady. She charmed the world in that role. But in fact, she was temperamentally not suited for it. She was too vulnerable, too sensitive, too appalled, where he could somehow turn the other cheek by all the criticism that descended on him as the country came to an end. Anyway, the West still sees him, most of us, as a great statesman, even if not as great as we thought at the time. But in his own country, he's widely despised. Now, in my previous talks, I've ended here, and I've left this picture on the screen, and somebody quite rightly told me, whoops, that I should end on a somewhat happier note by going back to the first picture. So there he is, and I invite your questions and comments. In the last chapter of my book, I talk about Gorbachev's attitude toward Putin. We didn't speak about it much, but I followed it in the press and on his website. He has a surprisingly mixed assessment of Putin. When Putin first came in the year 2000, Gorbachev welcomed him as a change from Yeltsin, who had been the president since 1991, and who had given Gorbachev a very hard time. I'll give you an example. In 2000, no, that example doesn't work. There are examples in the book. But anyway, so he was grateful to have somebody replace Putin. And he went so far as to say something puzzling, which is Russia may need a certain dose of authoritarianism. I take it that that meant he had learned perhaps a lesson from his own career in power, that Russia wasn't ready for democracy as quickly as he had hoped to bring it about. He also said at a later date it may take decades for Russia to be democratized. And he even went so far as to say at one point it may take the entire 21st century. But it's interesting, every time, and I shouldn't say every time, the few times there have been explosions of protest against Putin, 2011, 2012, when the election seemed to be partly rigged, and people came into the streets, tens of thousands, Gorbachev immediately forgets his pessimism and thinks we may be back on track toward democratization. One other thing about his attitude and Putin's, they're much closer on foreign policy than they are on domestic. Gorbachev has regretted the Putin crackdown on the press and the arrest of certain liberal-minded oligarchs and other things that have gone on. But in foreign affairs, they're both very critical of the United States. Gorbachev at one point went so far as to say that after the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States looted us and kept us down. This may, again, if you want to talk about this, this may have to do with his own feeling of having been betrayed by the Bush administration. But at any rate, that's his view. He approved of the annexation of Crimea. He didn't blame Putin for the invasion of Ukraine. He does say that, like him and Reagan, Putin should talk, first with Obama, now with Trump. So he's still pushing talk as a way to end the tension, but it's a mixed picture. Yes?
How does Putin portray Gorbachev?
Well, all you have to know is that famous saying of Putin's, which is the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And who brought it about in Putin's mind? Gorbachev. He's treated him until fairly recently fairly well. He invited him to the Kremlin. They talked a couple of times. At one point, when Gorbachev was trying to set up a Russian Social Democratic Party on the model of Germany or Sweden or something like that, Putin actually said to him, this was way back, though, I think in... I forget the year, maybe 2003, he said to him something like, we do need a center-left party. But I think Putin himself has become more and more authoritarian as the years have passed, and he obviously doesn't, at this point, welcome parties that
that are at all independent. Yes?
It seems to me that the leadership of Russia that you mentioned, Andropov, Chernikov, Andropov, Beria, the former heads of the KGB, Gorbachev rose from the minor leagues of that leadership. In my estimation, as you know, I've done work to try to rescue Wallenberg from the Soviet Union, in my capacity as an international lawyer. They're a group of liars, including Mr. Gorbachev, who was very clever in playing the system. Gorbachev didn't manage the economy of Russia. Reagan forced him into bankruptcy. When you go bankrupt, you lose power. When you lose power, you invent theories of democracy. I love your book. I've read your book with care. It's brilliantly written. I just simply, from my own experience dealing with the Russians, have found not one of them worthy of trust, including Mr. Gorbachev, who had a great childhood and wanted to do some good things, but I think your closeness with him may shade your thoughts, and I'm just another academic in a way. Raising a dialogue that's not personal, just my own.
Well, thank you for the comment. First of all, Gorbachev was never a KGB guy, although he was promoted by Andropov in the political hierarchy. And I know that Gorbachev, as the leader of the Soviet Union, lied quite often. I asked him at one point about what we now know was the continuation of Soviet bacteriological warfare preparations, even after they signed an agreement not to do that, and he wouldn't admit it. He still doesn't admit it, but we know that it went on. There are other occasions. I think compared to previous Soviet leaders and compared to Putin, he was an angel. You may say that's a pretty low bar, and it certainly is. But I take your point, but I insist nonetheless on seeing him as heroic given the situation he operated under and what he tried to achieve. Yes?
So I really appreciate your talk. I've puzzled since he came into office and Perestroika and Glasnost, etc. How did this creature of the apparatus become a visionary? And it seems your take on it is that he was always a visionary. He was just keeping it under wraps until he could do something with it?
I don't think he was a visionary from the moment he emerged from his mother's womb. No, I think as a school kid, he bought into the Stalin propaganda. One of the lines I have in my book is a famous line from that period in which young Soviet kids were pushed to say, "Thank you, Comrade Stalin, for our happy childhood. And one of the points I make is that, ironically, Gorbachev had a happy childhood in these terrible times, which I think, as I explained, helps to explain his surprisingly sunny outlook on the world. He describes how when his maternal grandfather, the one we saw with his arm on Gorbachev's shoulder, was brought back from the gulag, he spent that one evening describing the tortures that he went through, and you can imagine some of them. Then he never talked about it again. But can you imagine an 8-year-old, 9-year-old kid sitting there listening to his grandfather describe how they hung him upside down and all the other terrible things they did to him? So he knew at some level from pretty early on that a lot of the propaganda was just that. There were terrible things going on. His remark to Mlynarsh as they watched that movie, he welcomed Khrushchev's reforms as quite a few others did. But, you know, over the years, his thinking got more and more complex and nuanced. I think he probably came pretty late to his view that Soviet foreign policy was bankrupt and that the Cold War should be ended. I remember when Gorbachev and Reagan had that Geneva summit in 1985, Gorbachev had a news conference I was watching on television, and I heard him say something that to me was stunning. He said, "We understand that our security depends on your, America's, also feeling secure. This was a revolution, because up until then, they had understood their security depended on our feeling insecure. I don't think he had that kind of view early on. So it's, you have to try to watch it grow and expand and over the years. Yes, here, yes.
Yes, we were, just recently, we saw a news program about the Soviet meddling in American elections, and they made the point that it goes as far back as Truman, attempts to interfere in the elections. Truman was offered help and rejected it. John Kennedy, similarly. Was there any hint during Gorbachev's time that he was in any way attempting to influence America?
Well, of course, the Soviet Union from the very beginning thought of itself as only the beginning of a world revolution, welcomed the appearance of communist parties in other countries like Germany, welcomed the prospect that they could seize power and take over those countries. During the war, at one point, the Red Army got almost to Warsaw in Poland before it was turned back. In 1920, I believe. So they were out there pushing as hard as they could. I think we often exaggerated the extent to which they had a chance to succeed. And after a while, even somebody like Stalin understood that if you push too far, like into Western Europe after World War II, you might get control of countries that could make your life miserable. So he settled, as it were, for East Europe, which he could control because his troops were there. And I'm sure they operated within the technology available at the time to promote peace groups that they thought as helping them, besides communist parties. Of course, the other side of this, I don't know if you remember a piece in the New York Times Sunday Review some months ago, which talked about the way we had maneuvered to get our way in other countries like Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 54, and other cases. This, of course, brings up the old argument about moral equivalence or not. Well, that was us. We stand for democracy, so when we do it, it's okay. And I don't know whether we've ever, whether we have ever tried to use our ability to hack to meddle in their elections. Of course, at this point, it won't help because they're controlling their elections in the way that they do. So, if you're cynical, you say this is the way the world is. There's one other comparison, though, that I would make. I think Putin sees this through his paranoid lens. After the Soviet Union fell for the next 5 to 10 years, American groups like the National Democratic Institute of the Democratic Party and the Republican Institute of the Republican Party and other groups sent Americans over there to help them learn democracy, learn how to campaign, learn how to run for office. We had non-governmental NGOs of all kinds helping them to in the area of ecology and everything else. I think Putin's view is that this, he probably looks at this and says, what's the difference between this and what we're alleged to have done? You could say, well, we did it by invitation at that time. We did it out in the open. We didn't deny it we admitted it all the way. So there are important differences between, everybody maneuvers in the world, but people maneuver and states maneuver differently. I'm looking to see yes, ma'am.
What did you say? I'm wondering whether or not you have thoughts about whether his birthmark, his very visible birthmark, had any impact on the man he
became. Can you repeat your question?
I was wondering if you have any ideas about whether or not his visible birthmark had any impact on the man he became.
His visible birthmark. Well, you see, it's visible there.
In Russian peasant folklore, it's a bad sign, the mark of the devil. That apparently didn't stop his parents or grandparents from loving him, although we do know that his parents wanted to name him Victor, and his grandparents secretly got him baptized and changed the name to Mikhail, which has more
biblical connotations. Victor might even have been an effort to anticipate the victory of the first five-year plan of Stalin. That's about all I can say about birthmarks, I'm afraid. Yes? I think he did anticipate that his reforms would lead to efforts at reform in Eastern Europe. And in fact, to the extent that he did, he hoped for that, because if people like him had come to power in Eastern Europe, then you might have had long, enduring, reformed communist or even social, quasi-social democratic countries. One of the puzzles that I talk about in the book is that he didn't push for that kind of change. That is, there were moments, there was one moment in particular in 1988 when he went to Prague, and his aides thought that they had convinced him, once he was there, to disavow the Soviet crushing of the 1968 Prague Spring. But when he got there, he didn't do it. And in other cases, when he might have had a chance to push people like himself into power, he didn't do it. That's one of the puzzles I try to figure out in the book. And at first I look at what he says, and what he says is, I understood that one must not interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. But, I mean, that sounds pretty pure, but the Soviet Union had done that endlessly in Eastern Europe. Well, might he have thought, therefore, that it would only be evening the scales to interfere, but he didn't do it. Another reason was, by that point, they had lost a lot of their economic leverage. In the early years, they had subsidized those countries to beat very generously or selfishly. But by his time, oil prices and gas prices had fallen, and they were struggling themselves economically. A third reason he didn't do this, I think, and maybe here I'm just sort of interested again in personality, but I came to the conclusion after looking at his interactions with people, the leaders like Zhivkov in Bulgaria, Ceausescu in Romania, that he hated these guys and he thought they were hopeless. And he sort of decided, my main task is to make peace with the United States. That's what I have to concentrate on. So I'm not going to waste my time on these guys who are hopeless. Yes. It's interesting you should ask that. I just got sent a copy of the Claremont Review of Books from Claremont in California. This is a quite conservative publication, and there's a review of my book in it, and it's on the whole a favorable review. But he gives me a very hard time because he pulls out what he regards as evidence that Gorbachev was actually a secret believer. I don't know. I don't think so. Gorbachev, I think, would deny that. He did ease up on the repression of religion. When we were there in 1988 for several months, we went to an Easter service. And when he took over in 1985, I think the number of Jews who were allowed to emigrate was something like 6,000. I may be wrong, but by 1991, it was hundreds of thousands, a couple of hundred thousand. So he was, as in so many other ways, a kind of liberal in the broadest sense of that term. But I really don't know enough about his personal religious beliefs to do more than doubt it when Claremont says he was a believer. I think it may be that we are supposed to stop after an hour, and it's kind of hot in here anyway. So perhaps we should, and as I say, I will be outside, happy to sign books if you'd like to buy some.